Next, we will hear from Emily Marker, who is an assistant professor of history at Rutgers Camden. She was a 2015-16 dissertation fellow at the University of Chicago's Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture, where she completed her PhD with distinction. She is currently working on a book about racial reconstruction in post-war France at the crossroads of African decolonization and early European integration. She has published on Franco-African conversations about race and racism in French politics, culture, and society, an article of 2015, and most recently about writing structural racism into contemporary French history in an H-Trans forum in 2017 on the French Caribbean, and Jennifer Botin was also part of that forum. She is the co-founder of the Race and Pedagogy Working Group at the University of Chicago. She has organized workshops, teach-ins, and community classes on power, privilege, and inclusive teaching in Chicago, both on and off campus, and currently is a member of Rutgers Camden's Committee for Institutional Equity and Diversity. Today, she will speak to us about equity and empowerment in the way that we think and talk about race in our work and our classrooms, and situate these issues in the broader context of anti-racist activism in the academy in the U.S. and contemporary France. Emily.
Okay, so I don't know if I'll actually do all of those things that I said I was going to do, because I only have 7 minutes. I was going to start by talking a little bit about how I came to the Race and Pedagogy Group. It was fall 2014. I was teaching a class on race and anti-racist activism in Europe since 1945. And of course, this was the moment when the decision not to indict the police officer who murdered Michael Brown, that happened. So activism on campus was everywhere. Our students were really feeling a need to talk about this stuff, especially in a class like mine where we were talking about race and anti-racist activism. And they were really frustrated that there was no other space on campus for them to talk about it, and that the rest of their faculty really wasn't comfortable talking about it. So, we talked about this, graduate students, faculty, and we felt like we need to actually make time to create that space where we can talk about race and pedagogy together, because they just don't exist otherwise. And I would just say that this is happening really across the country. There are a lot of groups like this on campuses, both in France and in the U.S. And, we talked to, Perry Reed has been mentioned as a place where, scholarship on race has really been embraced and flourishing. It's also a place where activism is very strong. And even in that context, where you have a university that is really welcoming to the study of race, there are real tensions between the scholars of race on that campus and the more radical activist groups that are sort of, messing things up, right? I felt this when I was there giving a talk in the Papillon Saint Noir seminar. And, these are sympathetic folk that felt really uncomfortable about movements like the Camp d'été décolonial, which embraces a principle of non-mixité, right? So it excludes white folk from participating in their anti-racist activism, and for this reason is successfully framed as anti-white racism. It's worth noting that RT, Russian television, has picked this up and has published and covered this topic, so much so that Anne Hidalgo had to prohibit one of these groups from having a meeting in public place in Paris. So there's a lot happening right now with, anti-racist activism and the study of race, and the tensions and intersections between scholarship in the academy and activism. So I'll talk a little bit about that, and also as a way of giving a teaser for the workshop that we will be doing with Christy and J.P. Dotton after lunch. So my remarks will be sort of brief and vague, really meant to be a teaser. But I wanted to start with Tyler's point last night that now in the academy and in the humanities especially, we're increasingly being asked, and consequently asking ourselves, how and why does what we do matter? Tyler argued in his talk that studying racial and class politics in 1919 in French history can illuminate aspects of how race, class, and racism work today. And I just want to stress, this is kind of obvious maybe, but just to make it even more explicit, that that's so important, because making those dynamics visible is the essential first step to combating structural racism. that might not be the what many university administrators want to hear as a justification for our continued existence, but I think it's important that we let ourselves recognize that and just how much that kind of work matters. I think since the election, lots of folks feel sort of adrift and lost and disoriented, feeling helpless, unsure of what to do, how to resist the constant onslaught on values and institutions that many of us, if not most of us, hold dear. And I think one of the ways that this has manifested itself, I've seen in and beyond the academy, is people sort of thinking about what kind of organizations they can get involved with, making donations, what have you. But I think that one of the best, most effective, and longest lasting things to do is to really commit ourselves to pushing for equity, justice, and empowerment where we already are, to work to democratize the spaces we already inhabit at our home institutions, in our departments, in our field, and in our classrooms. So that probably all sounds fine, well and good, but as has sort of been alluded to already, the pivot from generalized ideas of equity and inclusion to the specific task of combating structural racism often conjures up various forms of resistance on multiple levels. And one very basic variant of that resistance stems from just a sense of feeling like you don't know where to start. And that is precisely why we've organized this hands-on workshop after lunch, where we can talk about concrete strategies and practices we can all employ to confront structural racism in our research and in our teaching. So some of us may be able to do that more or less through our research, and JP will talk a bit about that this afternoon. But regardless of our areas of specialization, we can all do this through our teaching. So I want to emphasize that this can, but does not only have to do with course content. I want to suggest today that we can all work towards turning our classrooms into sites that disrupt the relations of power, privilege, and authority that sustain white supremacy. So did I just tell you all that you are responsible for working to end white supremacy? And the answer is yes, I did. And if that makes you feel uncomfortable, that is totally okay. It's normal and to be expected, because that's actually how structural racism works. That's how it reproduces itself. Structural racism is maintained when honest dialogues about race get shut down. So again, this question of visibility and invisibility is so key to keep our sights on at all times, in our research, in our teaching, in just the way we inhabit our spaces in our institutions. So what concretely am I talking about? I think that when presented with the raw material of French history, and not just colonial history or questions of empire, or when we're talking about the experience of people of color in France and overseas territories, students intuitively make connections between what they're learning in class and in the contemporary U.S. context. I work at a satellite campus of a public institution, and my students are making those connections. The key is, how do we build community in the classroom so that we can productively engage those connections in the room, right, without shutting them down? So just to give an example, last week I was teaching the Dreyfus Affair, I was explaining Edouard Drumont and political anti-Semitism, racist anti-Semitism, talking about the rise of a new kind of press, talking about how he really founds a journal, a modern news outlet that is sort of unique and pioneering as an openly racist, anti-Semitic publication in a modern, sort of supposedly stable democracy. And that the name of that publication translates to free speech, right? La Libre Parole. And so the question is like, how do you create a and immediately, of course, everybody was like, jaws drop. This is so shocking. I can't believe this. And we had to talk about it, right? We talked about free speech and the politics of race in this country right now, of which they're all very aware of. And the question is how do you as an instructor feel comfortable and confident to manage a discussion that goes in that direction, that can really erupt at any time? So building that comfort and that confidence as facilitators of conversations about race is what we'll focus on a lot in the workshop this afternoon. I will conclude in a second and just say that this takes time and effort. It can be hard and it can be painful, but I suggest that that's how you know that it actually matters and that you're actually doing something that is worth doing. The good news is that there are loads of resources out there for how to do this, and And this afternoon, I'll draw on a couple of different approaches, sort of give you not like a real smorgasbord, but a couple of examples. I'm going to use some of the work of bell hooks, who is coming at these issues from a critical pedagogy tradition and a feminist tradition. I'll also introduce some research from social psychology and the dynamics of racial dialogues. This is kind of a problematic field, but there are useful insights to draw from and some concepts to work with. And we'll use those this kind of work to collectively think about strategies and specific practices we can all experiment with in our teaching. So.
Thanks, Emily. Finally, we will hear from Namisha Barton. She has served as the Associate Director of Programs for Access and Inclusion at Princeton University since 2015. At Princeton, she runs the Freshman Scholars Institute, a summer academic bridge program for students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who are the first in their families to go to college. She also launched Princeton University's first four-year scholars program for first-generation low-income students, the Scholars Institute Fellows Program, which has been featured in Harvard Alumni Magazine, the New York Times, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and, come January 2018, 60 Minutes. Her current professional interests are directly... look out for that one. Her current professional interests are directly related to her scholarly and research interests, namely examining how so-called outsiders become insiders. She completed her PhD in history at Princeton in 2014 and a dual BA in history and religious studies at Berkeley in 2006. Her research on gender, sexuality, and immigration in modern France has appeared in French Politics, Culture, and Society and the Journal of Women's History. She is also currently completing her book manuscript, Reproductive Citizens, Gender, Immigration, and the State in France, 1880 to 1945. Today she will speak to us about scholarly identity and the embodiment of difference, the purpose of diversity and inclusion efforts targeting undergraduates and graduate students, and ways to make classrooms welcoming and inclusive for all. Namisha.
All right. Thank you very much for waiting until the bitter end. I hope it's not too bitter. Christy, thank you so much for inviting me to participate on this very distinguished panel. It's really an honor to be here with all of you. As Christy said, my story will move in these sort of three movements, and I'm really going to echo the last three speakers that you heard. When I speak about scholarly identity and the embodiment of difference, you will hear echoes of Robin. When I speak about what brought me to diversity and inclusion work and why I hope it's not segregation and integration work, you will hear echoes of Tyler. And finally, when I end with these meditations and open questions about how to make the classrooms more welcoming and inclusive for all, you will once again hear Emily. So first, I'd like to start by just saying the personal is political, but the personal is also scholarly. At the SFHS panel in April, I was asked to reflect on what caused me to study immigration, gender, sexuality, and empire in modern France. And of course, I was participating on a panel with mid-career and senior colleagues who were describing how their research trajectories had changed over time, which of course they do. What I explained then was that I did not come to those subjects. Those subjects came to me. I grew up in a mixed immigrant household. Stories of empire abound in my home and still do. Stories of single immigrant motherhood fill my memories. Mixed marriage, mixed families are the stuff of more than just research. It's my reality. So little wonder then that my research interests closely mirror those realities. Now, when I went to Berkeley as an undergrad, I was inspired, of course, by what I learned in my French history courses, but the idea of getting a PhD in history literally never crossed my mind. And as is often the case for first-generation, low-income, immigrant, and URM students, it was really faculty and graduate mentors who first suggested that possibility to me, and I think it's both wonderful and terrible that two of them are sitting here at this table today, Robin and Tyler, yes. Their very existence, and this is to repeat what Robin said, their very existence as persons of color in the discipline probably shaped my understanding of what was even professionally possible, even more than I could have articulated at the time. Now, as a first-gen low-income woman of color pursuing a PhD in history, European history at Princeton, there were certain obstacles to overcome, and we will leave it at that. But instead, I would like to focus on the ones that you may not often hear about. So, for instance, at conferences like these, where senior scholars and some peers would ask me, quizzically, why France? I was really being asked to sort of justify my scholarly identity as a result of my difference, my diversity, as though only some scholars truly have the option to be cosmopolitan in their interests, whereas we others, the diverse, are not really accorded the same right. And really, a hint of what I should really be studying hanging in the air. And then the equally perhaps more upsetting moment when I did state my research interests, immigration, gender, sexuality, and that look of relief, of total understanding that sort of dawns on them, as though that's the only way that it really makes sense. And I don't necessarily disagree with them. That's why I began with an autobiographical testimony that I'm sure made some people uncomfortable. So, you see, I struggle with this as well, and I'm trying to figure it out for myself. Just to give you another example, when I go to the archives in Paris, it is not a pleasant experience for me. When you're a woman of color who looks possibly Muslim, you are constantly subjected to harassment by scholars, by archivists, by people in the streets. Assumptions are being made about me based on the color of my skin. And I want to add here, that is both by white French people and immigrant men of color who make certain claims on my body because I look like I belong to their community and I am not wearing a headscarf. So these are just a couple of ways that the personal shapes the scholarly as a woman of color, both here and in France. And so I'm just going to sum up as follows. Sure, my personal background seems to naturalize my choice of subject matter. But actually, I believe all scholars have a personal relationship to their research interests. It's just that for some of us, we are often asked to account for and explain that relationship. And for others, that relationship has somehow been naturalized because of the undifference of their bodies and their selves. Also, identity shapes not only the academic choices you make in terms of your academic subject matter, but it also shapes the ways in which you can do your work. I'll just leave it at this. It would be a privilege to be able to go back to the archives in Paris, as I will do in January, and not to have to constantly account for my embodied existence. In sum, my career as a graduate student in French history gave me a lot of time to reflect on what it means to study difference while you embody it, not just in the world, but in the profession in which you've chosen. And I use that word chosen very specifically here, very intentionally, because I know we're here to talk about structural racism, but I also think it's important to balance considerations of a structural variety with my own personal decisions and choices. I stayed in it. Second topic that I'd like to discuss, what I do today and why I do it. As Christy said, in some ways, my professional work today is simply an extension of what animated me in my scholarly pursuits. How do outsiders become insiders, and what makes some insiders and some outsiders to begin with? As she said, I am responsible today for a four-year scholars program for first-generation low-income, or FLY, that's what they call themselves, FLY students at Princeton University. The purpose of the program, as I see it, is to render visible everything it takes for a student to succeed at Princeton. And here again, I say a student, not a FLY student, not a first gen, not a low income, not a minority student. It's intentional. It demonstrates what I believe is the case, that FLY students, minority students, they don't need anything special or different to succeed. They simply need access to the same resources, not just financially, but also in terms of just what we all take for granted, perhaps. They need access to those same resources as their better off peers. So for instance, I spend a lot of my time creating workshops on decoding the hidden curriculum, and these workshops build on themselves over time, and I'm sure this is what Emily, JP, and Christy will be talking about in the workshop to come. I've also grown increasingly interested in helping students navigate the politics of difference within the college setting. So in classrooms, with their professors, with their peers, and eventually, something that's not often talked about, with their families and home communities. We don't often think about it, but actually access to Princeton University or any other sort of any college education at all can be a one-way ticket out of home with no possibility of true return. And that can be very complicated in different ways, and I'm happy to talk about that in the Q&A. Now, these considerations that are both scholarly and personal have really determined the graduate curricula that I've come up with for now FLY and URM doctoral students at Princeton. It's really two curricula. The first for early career graduate students who need advice on how to navigate academia. The second for later career graduate students as they consider a post-PhD career. I can talk about what exactly those curricula look like, but instead I'd like to talk about the elephant in the room for both undergraduates and graduate students who come to my workshops. We're asking who mentored you and who didn't. What assumptions were made about you and which assumptions were not made about you? How has your difference shaped your scholarly, your personal, and your professional choices? And how can you now take power back? So now if I'm going to summarize again, what is diversity work? Well, in my opinion, it's about rendering visible the invisible, those standards, those norms, those cultures, those expectations in which and through which academics operate. I think that when it's articulated correctly, it can be understood not as extra handling of first-gen, low-income, and minority students, but rather as a clear curriculum that showcases everything it takes for any student to be successful. And in my opinion, this is the true purpose of diversity work. If and when it's done well, we as diversity practitioners, and that includes all of you, will have the great privilege of presiding over our own demise. What I mean is that we will hopefully no longer be necessary. Now I'm not talking about you, now I'm talking about myself. In that way, we can be the tide that lifts all boats. And now I've increasingly begun to work with faculty. That brings me to my third point, but I'd like to remind Christy that Tyler gave me some of his time. Now, recently I gave a talk to Princeton faculty about how to create a warm, inclusive, and equitable environment for students. And I think that surely part of setting that tone, especially in this day and age, must fall to the students. But how are we going to navigate those conversations, especially in the current political climate? So I'm going to end with a few questions that I think have been running through this panel this entire time that I hope might stimulate further discussion in the Q&A. So first, how can we set norms and expectations for challenging conversations in the classroom, especially when difference is very clearly on the table? So yes, think about conversations about empire, about immigration, about now the rise of right-wing movements and more. To make it very personal, let me say, what texts do you teach when you're thinking about these subjects? How do you or do you set norms with your students prior to their approaching the text so that you can ensure that the ensuing class conversation actually unfolds in the spirit in which you intended, and that and what happens when it doesn't? And this goes back to a point that Emily was making. Second, how can we help students develop a language for the uncomfortable ideas and feelings that they're going to encounter in academic spaces and specifically in our classrooms? After all, and this is what everyone is talking about right now, the purpose of education is to challenge and to some extent make us uncomfortable. So how do we challenge responsibly? Which I believe is to acknowledge that we ourselves do not know everything, that we ourselves do not understand all experiences, and we cannot hope to always get it right. How do we convey that sentiment to them as well? Third, how do we ensure that diversity efforts are not undertaken by those of us whose bodies and selves are always already marked by difference, but rather by all of us together as colleagues and as a community? And finally, how do we constantly interrogate how the past has shaped the opportunities and privileges afforded to many but not all? And here I'm thinking about what Christy said about structural racism as the silent opportunity killer. I'd never heard that before, but that's so fascinating. How is the deep past itself on full display in the makeup of any classroom, any department today? Now, I think that these explorations and questions can help all students and all of us, too. And I think that that can actually be the radical explanatory potential of studying difference in any form, either the way that you do it and I used to do it, or the way that I do it now, addressing structural inequality in my profession. It's a mission, certainly, that I came to, but I also think that it's one that history chose for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So without further ado, let's open a few questions on the floor. Do you want me to pass on this mic? Fabulous.
interested in people more uncomfortable, I'm going to throw the other elephant, or I guess lead, the other elephant in the room in as well. This room does not look like my university. This room does not look like my department. This room does not look like the faculty or the administration of my university. Because I teach in a comprehensive public university where I see many more people of color than I see here. Also, I teach in a university with a huge component of contingent faculty. And I teach in a university where most of my students spend their first 2 years of university in a community college where, again, they see many more people of color and you have many more people of color. Unfortunately, because, well, not unfortunately, I have a panel at the same time as the workshop, so I wanted to ask this question now because I can't bring it up later. But my view is we have to also deal with the issue of hierarchy in academia and the ghettoization in academia of the other in places where they don't get enough money to come to a conference like this. Okay? So I'm just curious to hear what anyone or everyone of the panel might want to say or contribute to that issue, because I think it's a requisite piece of this conversation. Thank you.
Actually, I think I was really taken aback by, really impressed by, touched by Robin's. Oh? Robin's comments that she is here because actually Tyler saw her. And so I think at your university, wherever you teach, you also can see somebody, right? And encourage them to flourish, to explore opportunities. So yes, there are inequalities, you know, within, you know, academia. But, you know, as scholars, we can, as teachers, it is our responsibility to see people, to see students, and particularly students of color, and encourage them to apply places.
I want to echo that really important comment about structural hierarchies in academia right now. It's very apparent to me that in a time of attacks on university structure of funding from states, and part of what is happening, I mean this about the best of my colleagues, the most well-meaning, good liberal people, is that we are creating this caste of people with tenure-track jobs who have security, and then this huge structure of people who are on these temporary appointments, and they are replicating this. They're mostly white men in these positions and women, and then we've got, when we bring in people of color, and it's at these places that are kind of temporary, and then they have to teach hours and hours, and I want to just to say, you know, Robin's not here because of Tyler. I mean, she is ish. I mean, Tyler was a really good advisor, but Robin is here because she's doing really classy, cutting-edge scholarship, and that's the key part. But it's not always recognizable in the terms that an older generation of scholars of what it meant to be a historian recognized in the same way. And so one of the challenges as somebody, you know, working with search committees right now is how do we frame the really important cutting-edge work that's being done and the importance of activism and service to these different communities as part of what we're looking for in the positions that we hire. And I guess one of the things that I think my campus is doing a very good job of identifying contributions to diversity. I mean, that's weighted as heavily as the fields in teaching and in research. And I just want to encourage you, as a structural way, you can build that in so that when you see somebody who's doing really exciting work with inspiration and outreach and so on, you can credit them for that labor in the positions that you're hiring in. So.
I just want to agree with the last two speakers and just say there's something to it, too. I think that you're getting at it with that idea that there's other kinds of work, right? So if we're going to be addressing structural racism and we're actually at institutions where our student body is the student body we want to help to make the next generation of academia, you know, and higher education, less white, right? More integrated, more egalitarian. But there's penalties sometimes within our specialty, our field, where we're not seen because the work that we're doing in our institution may in fact absent us in ways, maybe from conferences, but also maybe just from the time that it takes for deep thought and publication at the level of some of our other peers. But we're deeply invested in research, not just for ourselves because it's part of who we are, but also because that's the tie that brings in our students, right? All of our students. I really loved what you had to say about these are not just skills for, you know, students of color, first generation. These are really skills that we should bring to all of our students. And I think once we start looking at it that way, that's really helpful. But I think if we're starting to talk about how we're going to deal with it in our society, we also want to think about how we don't absent, by accident, scholars that are present with us. Because in some ways, we don't look like you, not just maybe, you know, this way, but on paper too.
So I'd like to see if I can collect my thoughts here. I should have done that before I got the microphone. But echo, I mean, something that both Tyler and Namisha brought up, which is a lot of this comes back to resources and the inequitable distribution of resources. And so a lot of young academics who wind up in predominantly teaching institutions, community colleges, or as contingent faculty will never receive the sorts of resources that it takes to make it to a research institution. And because of it's coming back to the structural racism, I mean, the kind of structural economic inequity will cause this kind of bifurcation of career trajectories that will always keep people who can't get access to those resources into those more luxurious tenure track positions, as resource starved as they are in the humanities, but still comparatively so. And I think that, I mean, that is a very key issue, and I really appreciate the way Namisha phrased it, is for first-generation students, low-income, focusing on what it takes for a student to succeed. And I would push us to consider what does it take for a scholar to succeed, and then look at what are the resources that the scholars that have made it already have access to. What privileges do they already have that are enabling them to get there? And then how can we lift, as you said, you know, the tide that lifts all boats, how can we lift everyone else up to that position?
Thank you all so much for these comments. It actually, just hearing you reminds me that, you know, we're talking about structural racism in the academy, but of course, you know, when our students come to us, they've experienced structural inequity in a variety of places, right? Within housing, you know, within their secondary schools, you know, just in terms of the resources that they have or have not had access to. I mean, that's part of the story that they're coming to us with, right? So it's a much larger question, and I don't know who I'm referring to here, but someone was talking about how we have to start with our piece, our corner, right? And I think what you're referring to is thinking about this as a longer, what we call pipeline issue, right? I mean, thinking about who gets into the colleges in the first place, who receives the kind of mentorship, what is the nature of that mentorship? A lot of the mentorship is, you know, just sort of basic skill building. And I didn't even know that, I didn't know what office hours were. I thought it was some weird thing that Berkeley professors kept putting on their syllabus, you know? I had no idea what it was. And then when I realized that the only way to get into graduate school was that you have had to have these letters of recommendation. I was already a junior, and I was like, oh no, what am I? You know, so these are the kinds of conversations that I had with mentors, right? I think to your point about resources, like that knowledge is a resource. And so who has had that knowledge in the past and thus has not needed that more formalized system of mentorship in the past, right? That's another way of sort of thinking about it. I'm thinking also about what you said about who winds up sort of making it as a scholar and who does not, right? You know, we talked about adjuncting. Well, some people have the financial resources to hang on for a very long time through adjuncting, and some do not, right? I think that that's another thing to consider. And I would say that the pipeline extends all the way to the sort of tenure moment, because when there are always certain people who are consistently called upon to be providing that knowledge, that mentorship, that sponsorship, that support to others. And if that is not rendered visible in the tenure file, they just become another case of someone who couldn't make it, right? And so I think it's a much longer, vaster sort of issue. And it starts with this wonderful piece of advice about rendering that visible too, that labor that scholars are putting in to invest in the future generation of scholars down the line. I think it really sort of starts there and must trickle down. And I think that's something that that everyone in this room could probably take action on tomorrow or Monday.
Emily, and then.
One short thing about that. Tom Holt once said, you know, as an observation about the way in which there was so much more mobility for African Americans in the military than there is in academia. And one of the main reasons is that there are very clear public rules, and it's just so transparent what you need to do to rise up, right? Whereas in academia, I mean, it's all hidden rules, hidden scripts, norms that nobody tells you about. So this is something we'll talk about in the afternoon, but I'm glad you raised that. Yeah.
Thanks. Oh, I've got a lot of people.
I guess the something that Tyler Stovall said really struck me about sort of where resources are going and how they're flowing to areas in which diversity is an even bigger problem than in the humanities. And I guess it seems to me that that's not an accident, and that it may in fact be that money is going into STEM because it is a place where there are fewer women and fewer minorities. And what we know about the history of industries is that when women and people of color start to succeed, the industry gets devalued. It is considered to have been de-skilled. And I'm not sure that's a hopeful observation, but it doesn't seem to me an accident that just at the moment when sort of several generations of effort to open the doors of the university are starting to come to fruition, that the response of our political culture is to say universities are either wasteful or dangerous and should be shut down or brought under control or reoriented to privilege precisely the sections of them that are not doing that work.
I'm pulling my thoughts together here. Thank you very much for a lot of insights, a lot of things to think about. And I want to kind of get at this question of how we talk about diversity. And just really briefly, I will do my own experience. I don't want it to be a woe is me kind of thing, because I've often had that experience early on in my career where I was the only person of color and woman of color at the entire conference. And I didn't have the grace, I had the disgrace of saying, I work on nuns. I don't work on race. And, you know, and it's been very interesting because I have had people explicitly say, well, why don't you work on India? Then if I didn't work on India, then why aren't you really working on race? And so I'm supposed to embody a certain scholarly discipline. And I've chosen not to do that. And I actually think of that as empowering, that I refuse to accept what is being scripted onto me. But I also get critiques and it's implicit, it's in the form of microaggression, because I don't do those things and somehow I'm not keeping up my end. And I also really recognize I have the privilege of class, and I have the privilege of working for an institution that, relatively speaking, has a lot of money. I don't want to hear about Princeton. Princeton has a lot of money. But what it really strikes me is that this issue of what constitutes diversity, we need to keep pushing at it, because that's also fluctuating. There's a hierarchy within diversity, and certain groups can be rendered visible. And what I've always found uncomfortable, and actually experienced in my own institution, is who gets to talk about diversity? Just as you get these things about who gets to teach European history. And I think that also comes out, I just want to say, if you are not seen as the person who should teach European history, that comes out in evaluations.
No kidding.
You know, you get evaluated in a way, and contested in a way that has ramifications in terms of your career. And that's a very real, real thing. And I've experienced that. And I'm sure there are people here. So I think it's also about this kind of who gets to define diversity, how we keep that open. And I guess this also goes to this issue of intersectionality, right? Because the position of the privileged and the oppressed is always shifting. That's another part of the theory of intersectionality, that itself is also, it's not just about these things intersecting. That's the part one. But the part two is about privilege and oppression being shifting. And I think that needs to be part of the discussion as well.
I may jump in really quick, Christy. Is that okay?
Really quick.
I want to kind of piggyback on a number of issues here. The first is this question of who gets to speak. And I feel like I need to confess, I've been dreading this roundtable. Some of you know. But at the same time, I feel an extreme responsibility to sit up here. And I've been dreading it because I feel like we have here, for the most part, all the people in French history who are of color who have been asked to stand up and share their experience and perform in a certain way, a kind of an experience in the academy. But at the same time, I feel like that is a responsibility that, you know, I have to embrace and take on. But I think that this conversation about responsibility, about mentorship, is an exceptional one. And I've been so pleased with the Western's development of the new mentorship program. And I really think that this question of responsibility, about who stands and speaks, about who's asked to perform a certain kind of whatever this is, but also the role that we can all play in helping to make outsiders insiders, to draw upon Namisha's point, helping to make obvious what are such obfuscated games, right? Politics, and the mentors, and we all can do this, right? It's not just Tyler, who's been a great mentor for me, but it's also the role we can all play in obviating these obscure politics. So,
thank you.
That's that issue that has been studied of cultural taxation, where the people who are embodying that difference feel that they always have to be the purveyor of these messages. And I think it's such an important takeaway today that we are all on the same team and we can all be purveyors of this change. And just one thing, since I have to carry the mic, going back to something that Jennifer said, that myself as an Enlightenment scholar and a scholar of military history, that I have never considered the possibility that my career would ever happen in France, that they're not going to have someone like me come teach them about the philosophe in one of the big Parisian universities, and not even necessarily about their great generals of Enlightenment and the first global wars. And so that has been a sort of strange thing always brewing inside of me, knowing that my career is here. This is where I can do this type of work.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank everyone for this panel, which is really, really important, and has been very provocative and awesome. My name is Tamara Chaplin. I'm an associate professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I'm sitting next to my colleague Andrew Ross, who's at University of Southern Mississippi. I'm a past member of the Committee on LGBT History, and Andrew is currently sitting on the Committee on LGBT History Board. And one of the things that I just want to raise is part of this conversation, I think, that we're having, which is about who is included and who is visible when we talk about diversity. Because we're invariably talking about race when we talk about diversity. This happens at my institution all the time in our department. And I think it's really important that we talk about how does that diversity get defined? And who does that silence? Who does that render invisible if we're talking about invisible minorities or other forms of oppression? And so my question for you, actually, all of you, is to what degree does that happen in your institutions? How can we change that? I know that it really affects the students in my classrooms. I also teach history of sexuality, so I often have students who are LGBT, transgender, things like that. And it's really important that their concerns also become part of our conversations when we're talking about questions of diversity and oppression. So I raise that to you just because that really was actually not discussed at all in this panel, which I know is called Addressing Structural Racism. So perhaps there's a justification for that absence, but I think it's a kind of structural oppression and prejudice which bears including in that general conversation. So, thank you.
Christy, I could actually jump in on that just very briefly, since it was sort of a question. I can project. Can I just project? Is that fine? All right. So, I'd like to say that two things. First of all, as someone who the first time she sat down to teach a class, students sat right next to her. I started the class and they jumped away from me because they didn't realize I was the teacher. And as somebody who, this literally happened, and as somebody who didn't have a parent who was an academic, the thing I learned very early on, which I think ties into this mentorship question we've been talking about, is the importance for me to ask questions of others, because I didn't know how anything functioned. I started academia because I liked writing and research. I didn't know what anything else was about. So I started by asking all those questions, and then I realized that nobody just told me this, so I try to pass forward all the things I didn't know, which I'm realizing other people can't guess either. And that's where the mentorship, I think, is particularly important, to remember all the things we didn't know when we were going through as undergrads and when we were going through as grad students, and pass that information on. And it is invisible labor. It does not show up anywhere, and I do not get any credit for the mentorship. But for me, it's one of the most important things I can do. And so that's something I would pass along. And then in questions of, you know, the other forms of inclusivity, one of the things that we did in our department that I'm actually pretty proud of, in the French department, is we actually have a dual degree with the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program. Mm-hmm. And that has made more visible among our students, those who are interested in questions of sexuality studies and gender and women's studies, the possibility to make that a part of how they study French culture and society or French literature, in ways that I think has really given them more voice and more visibility, and it has changed in some ways the makeup of the department in a positive way. And we've since added a dual degree with African studies, which we're still building up, but which has that same sentiment behind it of building these. And I know I'm coming from a French department in this sense, but we teach history there too. And we form people who teach history. And so those are some of the ways that we've been thinking through how to make it a more inclusive space. So that's just an idea, which could work, I think, in other places too, which is kind of building into the structure of the programs.
Could I just add one last thing to this diversity comment? Because diversity is in the title of my job. I think it's really interesting that institutionally, Princeton is always talking about, they don't say diversity, they say socioeconomic diversity. And there's a lot of energy around first-generation students and low SES students, and that's it. All that URM minority stuff, that was just me. And so often, but I think it goes to what you said about these labels. They can render stuff visible, but they can also obscure stuff as well. And I think that that's a really interesting silence that started happening at sort of an institutional rhetorical level. That's all I want to say.
Yeah.
I want to speak to this pipeline issue and sort of go back to where Gail started, and I guess maybe some of the things I was thinking about when Laura talked, and also with the overrepresentation of California on this panel, because I think this is really important, because I teach at a major elite institution away from a coast, Minayo. and we, I'm not going to say that we have no problems, and I'm not going to say it's everybody else's problem, but I want to say that one of the themes of internalization that has sort of come through all of this is that I want to, I guess, ask all of you who are teaching at institutions not like mine and not near mine to encourage your students to understand the power and privilege they will get from coming to an elite institution like mine. They're often, I think, afraid, of rightly, of being torn away from family and familiarity and all the things that got them to where they're in a position, and not knowing in all the ways that this is something they can do, and to say this is really only a few years of your life, you can then go and teach somewhere else. But the pipeline is partly, our pipeline problem partly can be addressed by everybody in this room encouraging their students of color to help them with the hidden curriculum, and to encourage them to understand that graduate school is a short stage in their lives that can open up the possibility of settling somewhere else where they might be more comfortable, and that also maybe it's okay and they can do this, and then to try to understand what their fears are, because if they need, because we can offer something that will launch them farther because of the power and privilege that comes from going to an elite institution. That pipeline problem is a real problem from undergrad to grad school. And so, and to also tell us what we can do to recruit better. We have some initiatives that we're part of, but I think that, and I don't think it's just us, I think that every elite institution is sitting there saying, what can we do? And this kind of conversation that can start here can continue to kind of develop ways to get that pipeline going to everybody's benefit.
I need to push back on that a little bit, because this idea that students are only going to be someplace for a little bit of time, some of them aren't going to survive that little bit of time. You know, I was lucky enough to go to graduate school as a grown-up, and it was isolating and debilitating. And the fact that I was at least old enough to have outside support systems is what saved me. You know, as a professor at Channel Island, I actually make a check mark every time a student comes into my office, mm-hmm. so that I can say, mm-hmm. in the work that I do, this is how many students I've seen. The 2 days before I left, I saw 27. Mm-hmm. And that was not a requirement. And 14 of them I've never seen before. And what most of them came in and said was, I heard you were here. So my response has to be, sit down. Right? But what happens if those students have no one to go to? 4 years of their life, they may not survive. So my job is to make sure they survive. But if there's no one that looks like me or nobody they can go talk to, then saying that we're going to get you through these 4 years isn't an acceptable response for me.
But if I can just speak back to that, to imply that coming to a major elite institution means to spend 4 years of your life at a place where there's nobody who looks like you is simply not well informed.
There are 3 African American professors of tenure at my institution, and I'm in California.
No, but what I'm saying is there are more than that in my department in Michigan. So the thing is, the students need to know that they are not going to be alone, that they are not going to be the only person of color if they go to some place that they've never been to before, and that's very different from their experience. And the only people they may trust to tell them that is you. So if you tell them that they need to stay here to stay safe, then I don't know how we can recruit these students.
Folks, I'm so sorry. We are, the plenary is about to start, the plenary lunch, and so the pressure is on for us to end this. Thank you, everyone.